Welcome to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Well, how are you?
I'm great.
Yeah, we were just talking about how great we all are, so I'm glad we captured that on tape. Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell you all a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report, but for Hollywood. After you're done checking out the day's headline, we hope you will stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. We have Craig Zoller talking about some of his favorite graphic novels, and we've got an essay coming out from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin on Sally Menke, the steady editing hand behind Quentin Tarantino's rise to prominence. The great Matt Labash will weigh in on Marvel vs. Marty, and Rebeller's own Dave Spielman will be lighting fires on the reg. We're paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. So we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access. It's just $1.99 a month or $20.19 for the whole year. Sign up, please. Thank you. And now, on to the show. First up is controversies and nontroversies. And guys, I don't mean to worry you, but this is a big one. This is a big one. It's huge. It turns out that Alan Moore has decided to one-up Martin Scorsese in the superhero slagging conversation, or at least he decided to do it a couple of years ago and then they reprinted it, so now we're just really, really reveling in it for the first time. Here is more on superheroes. These books and these iconic characters are still very much white supremacist dreams of the master race. In fact, I think that a good argument can be made for D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation as the first American superhero movie and the point of origin for all those capes and masks. End quote. This brings up an important question. Peter, who is your favorite superhero? Is it Iron Crossman or Ubermensch?
Yeah, thanks, Sonny. I appreciate that. That's that is in a completely appropriate stereotyping of me. No. So look, Alan Moore has been complaining about superheroes for practically as long as Alan Moore has been
almost certainly longer than he was writing superhero.
Right.
Novels.
I mean, if you go back to obviously Watchmen, but even before that with Miracle Man, in some ways Swamp Thing, his most famous works are anti-superhero works. And so it is just not in any way surprising that the guy who wrote an epic comic book series about how superheroes, if you take them to their logical end conclusion, end up being totalitarian murderous fascists, is now saying that actually also the new wave of popular superhero movies is very bad and even sort of white supremacist and racist.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I wouldn't even completely reject the idea that there is some thematic through line between not exactly Birth of a Nation and, you know, what the latest Avengers film,
mm-hmm.
but the idea that there's something that connects people engaging in dramatic extrajudicial acts while wearing masks. And in fact, you see that thematic idea being played out right now in the update to Watchmen, mm-hmm. on HBO.
And one of the ironies, yeah, of Moore's comments being sort of republished at this moment and of Moore hating, with some justification, adaptations of his work in general, is that this particular adaptation of his work has become directly engaged with the fantasy of sort of an Ubermensch, the idea that people have powers, by sort of retelling this superhero story through a lens of racial conflict in the United States. And so, to the extent that all of this is interesting, it's not because Moore is right, Moore is wrong. It's sort of a perfect example of just a conversation gone disastrously,
mm-hmm.
wrong,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not so much that you can debate whether or not superheroes are fascists and beyond the question of extrajudicial violence and hoods and masks. I mean, superheroes are stories about people who are in some way or other better than other people and derive authority from that, to take that metaphor.
Although in Moore's stories, they are often revealed to be actually much worse.
Absolutely. But it's more a conversation. You can debate all of the specific points here, but at the end of the day, this is how a cultural conversation just implodes right. on the internet, right? That's what it's the perfect example. Yeah.
So one funny footnote here that we should like add in is that these remarks are not actually recent. They came in, well, this is I think, 2016?
2017, I think.
Maybe 2017. Yeah. It was several years ago.
This is new.
They're not new. They're new to us, but they're not actually new remarks.
This is why I made my point in the introduction that it's not really that he's trying to one-up Marty. It's that he has one-up Marty long ago. Look, I think that there is
Marty is the hipster trying to bandwagon.
He's trying to get back
for superheroes.
So, you know, I mean, I do think there's I think Alyssa's point here is a very good one, that this is just like pouring gasoline onto the internet fire, like handing a bunch of people who are already like, yeah, Martin Scorsese is right. These movies aren't cinema. This is, you know, we live in this terrible corporate.
Not only are they not cinema, they're racist.
They're not only not cinema. They're also racist, and they're also infantilizing and bad for democracy and bad for the human condition. I do think it is an escalation worth considering just for a moment, because there is a difference between saying these things are infantilizing and these things are corrosive to any sense of social cohesion that we have, because that's essentially what he's saying here, is that this is a way to perpetuate the injustice that began with slavery and continues to this day.
But this is one of the reasons that the current adaptation of Watchmen is so interesting. Spoiler alert, if you haven't watched the November 24th
episode.
This Extraordinary Being, it's
really... I have not watched it.
I also have not watched it.
Don't
spoil it.
I'm a little bit behind on this show.
Do you guys both want to put your fingers in your ears and go la 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 while I discuss this for a while? Or how do we want to handle this?
That'll show up on the... Well, we're going to have a whole Watchmen episode later in the show. So I think okay. we need to... I think
but
we'll save it for there.
The most recent episode of the show essentially is an exploration of what happens when Black people get the sort of power and impunity that previously have been reserved for white people, and argues that, in fact, that there is no sort of moral way to wield this kind of impunity and this power in tandem, that inevitably you will become some kind of monster. Mm-hmm. And that is a fascinating... I mean, Moore objects to the adaptations of his work in part because they've often gone extremely poorly. See League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
See Zack Snyder's Watchmen.
Wrong. It's an excellent adaptation.
But what's happening in this adaptation is Moore's point taken to a place that he didn't actually go in the original Watchmen, addressing directly his point about superheroes being a white supremacist fantasy. And so the irony of all of this is that Alan Moore is simultaneously right and wrong on the internet. He is the Schrodinger's cat of internet takes. But it's also just like we should all go offline and live in huts.
You almost wonder, though, if Damon Lindelof, who is running who was the showrunner for the HBO version of Watchmen, had access to a translation of Moore's remarks or to this interview, which took place a couple of years ago as he was developing the show. I'm not saying I have obviously no reason to no specific evidence,
but it feels deeply engaged.
Kind
with
of feels
the points
like he had some sort. He was aware of this conversation.
Yes, and again, we will discuss Watchmen at greater depth at a later time. I do wonder if it is worth thinking just very, very briefly about whether or not he is right to say that the whole superhero thing is a kind of retardation of like social movement forward into like people being grown adults, or if we are willing to accept the idea that the Marvel movies are like other genres in the past, just a form of mass entertainment like any other. And if it really makes a difference, if it matters.
So I think that the Marvel movies in particular, and I'm talking about the movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that are now produced by Disney, are for the most part comfort food. And that's okay. There's a place for comfort food. Sometimes McDonald's is delicious and tasty. It probably shouldn't be your entire diet or even most of your diet. But I think it's wrong to say that superhero movies in general are like this. And if you look at the Nolan Batman trilogy, or if you look at the last couple of Wolverine films, Logan in particular, and you mentioned, you know, sort of are superhero movies keeping us in a permanent adolescence? Logan is a movie about dealing with old age and time and legacy and violence, and I wouldn't say that it's the most sophisticated adolescent film I've ever seen. Sure, there's a kind of adolescent. Yes, there is a young character in there.
But the thing is, people put adolescent lenses on all sorts of not just popular culture but politics, right? I mean, there is a reason that Vince Gilligan was so frustrated by the Breaking Bad fans who just wanted to watch Walter White kill people and be awful to his wife. I mean, that adolescent lens exists regardless of what people put in front of it. But I do think there is a legitimate question to be asked if there is a way to persuade people that a different lens is superior or to train them to use it. And I don't know. I mean, art doesn't inherently have a responsibility to make us decent adults or decent people. In an environment where people are trying to spend a fairly limited number of entertainment dollars on a huge range of options, if they're gravitating towards a set of things that are fundamentally adolescent, and because that's what the sort of common cultural conversation is, you know, and those things tend to be entirely adolescent, there's some sort of screwy feedback loop.
Let me resist this just a little bit. I guess I just don't feel like there's any golden age of where the median viewer of movies or consumer of pop culture or whatever, and certainly no time in the post-war era where most people, the average person, was consuming something that the kind of the literati, the highbrow folks, you know, sort of would consider, oh, this is truly excellent stuff. In fact, if anything, there are more people consuming upper middle brow, the kind of, let's call it, you know, Game of Thrones and The Sopranos, that sort of
class. That is definitionally middle brow. I mean, that is there's no upper middle brow. That is just the middle brow.
That is upper middle brow.
But I mean, I think the issue here, right, is that the comic book fans want to have their cake and eat it too. It's not just that they want to have the movies and watch them and enjoy them. They also demand to be celebrated for them and for them to be awards caliber films.
Well, and for them to be recognized as morally sophisticated.
And for them to be taken seriously. For them to be taken seriously as big A art, right?
But not just big A art, as
big C cinema.
Big P politics to a certain extent. I mean, the extent to which, like, progressive critics of media will just sort of cape for the mildest gestures in any area from the company is absurd, right? I mean, the idea that Tessa Thompson has one line about, like, getting to be king of Asgard and then says something in a press conference about Valkyrie finding her queen, and, like, that's supposed to mean that Marvel has an LGBT character? I mean, this is ridiculous.
Marvel's so woke now. No, but also, or like, for instance, Josh Gad was recently in the news talking again about how he had suggested LeFou in the live-action Beauty and the Beast remake should dance with a man, as if this is like an enormous, you know, step forward in the annals of
I do think there's something in the fan culture that is defining the standards downward, and I think
the fan and critical culture. I mean, the critics need to accept some responsibility here. Like you said, caping for a giant conglomerate every time they do some sort of hand wavy, oh, look at us, we're woke now thing is embarrassing. It's embarrassing. Not only for the studios to pander like this, but it's embarrassing that the pandered, you know, eat it up.
I think it's a bad way to think about films, and it's a bad way to make films. But it's not necessarily a new one. And when I say a bad way, what I'm specifically talking about is finding these little tiny moments that are not sort of that don't really have much to do with the structure of the story or the characters
or the argument,
right? Yeah. With what the films mean on a deeper and broader level. But this sort of thing, that the paying attention to those sorts of details has been something that Hollywood in particular has, like, stressed about for decades. I remember back in the Brosnan era of James Bond, there were reports about like these huge, huge fights and meetings over whether James Bond could snowboard or whether he had to use traditional skis, because like one was essential to the character of James Bond and the other one was just like, no, he's like a hipster Gen X, you know, like the X Games, like this is crazy. And like, I forget actually which I think at some point he did end up snowboarding, but I can't remember.
Yeah, I seem to remember
and
that they,
and there is just like, guy. There's way too, on the one hand, you understand these are multi-billion dollar IPs and you can't screw them up. On the other hand, there's just way too much obsession with these little tiny signifiers and not nearly enough attention paid to the deeper structural, you know, sort of messages that are sent by the stories and how they're arranged.
Well, and I think, I mean, to get us back to Alan Moore, right? You can, there has always been popular cinema. There's always been popular art. What it says has changed from era to era, right? I mean, there's a difference between the popular art being Casablanca or Westerns and superhero movies. They say different things about, you know, goodness, individual responsibility. And I think the thing about superhero movies that is unnerving to Moore and is troubling to me is that superhero movies posit that there's this sort of separate class of citizens who are better than us somehow and suggest that we can kind of offload our moral responsibility and our concerns to them. And I think that's maybe not great. It's maybe not ideal. And there's always going to be popular art.
But haven't movie protagonists, at least in the sort of post-Star Wars era, always been kind of superhero types, right? There have always been people who are deeply good in a way that most normal humans are, deeply and simply good, right? You hear screenwriters talk about, a character who's rootable, right? Like somebody who you really like,
but
who the audience just is like, yes, I just want this person to win against the forces of darkness.
But there's a difference between,
you know,
being good and being able to pick up a bus, right? I mean, you can be good by, you know, you can be Shane, you can be, you know, the decent person in your small town movie, and anyone can do that. It gives you something that you can realistically aspire to, but none of us are going to punch through an entire supervillain spaceship. Like, it creates all of our moral conflicts as if they exist
Speak
on
for
a scale.
Yourself.
Yeah, I mean, as it's really because I'm all a lady, I'm not going to be able to punch through an alien
good point.
Spaceship.
This is why we need Captain Marvel to make you think that you can do that. All right, so guys, is Alan Moore's description of superheroic white supremacism a controversy or a non-troversy? Alyssa?
It's a non-troversy.
Yeah.
Non-troversy.
Non-troversy.
Wow, hey, now I feel like I have to say it's a controversy, but it is in fact a non-troversy because nobody cares what Alan Moore thinks. Cranky old man.
Which is in and of itself kind of controversial.
He worships a puppet snake god from ancient Egypt.
Look, I'm just saying, nobody cares what he thinks, so he can take his old man complaints.
Is the
and
official stance of the podcast anti snake god from ancient
yes.
Egypt?
Come on,
obviously
it's ridiculous.
Snake gods are controversial. All right, so up next,
puppet snake gods, man.
In home theaters this week is Martin
Those of
Scorsese.
Us who worship actual snakes.
You done? Can I finish reading my script here? Thank you. In home theaters this week is Martin Scorsese's long gestating gangster epic, The Irishman, a pseudo, that is to say, unfactual account of the killing of Jimmy Hoffa, played by Al Pacino, by low-level mobster Frank Sheeran, played by Robert De Niro, at the request of upper-level mobster Russell Bufalino, Joe Pesci. But getting hung up on the facts is kind of beside the point here, as this movie is less interested in what really happened or didn't happen than it is about the relationships we form and the bonds we break when we decide to, do bad things. There are so many different things to discuss here. The de-aging technology made to use De Niro, in particular, look younger. The release strategy by Netflix. But the thing I have to know more than anything else... Did you guys leave the theater during the 3.5-hour running time to go to the bathroom? And if so, how many times? Alyssa?
Zero.
Zero times. Peter?
Once.
Oh, wow. Here's, so
Didn't
my...
Didn't you leave the theater to
I did.
Take
no,
a
no,
meeting?
I did. No, well, I left the theater for about 5 minutes for a phone call, and when I came back, nothing had happened. And this is my big take on the film, is that... It is unnecessarily long. There are movies that are necessarily long, and there are movies that are unnecessarily long, and this movie is unnecessarily long.
This is a deeply
it is
wrong opinion,
self-indulgently
Sonny.
Long. It is I understand the whole thing that you need to watch these guys grow together and then grow apart and then come back together, and then you got to get the murders in, and then you got to watch how it interacts with the family, and it's a span of decades, and it's about the American labor movement, which is the most important thing in the world, apparently, according to Martin Scorsese. But I was a little bit bored.
It makes you feel the weight of the passage of time. Ugh. It brings you into the experience of aging through these decades. Mm-hmm. And so when you start with him as an old man and then have these recollections, by the end of the movie, when you come back to the De Niro character as an old man in a kind of a nursing home or assisted living facility, right, you have gone through a kind of an epic journey of time with him. And so this movie is... Like, I was worried that it was going to be too long, and I'd heard people complain that, you know, sure, it could be 20 or 30 or 45 minutes shorter. I actually think it's just the right length, and the slowness of it, the methodical nature, sort of the way that it brings you in to the passage of time by forcing you to sit through all of it is totally deserved and totally necessary. And I also think, since you brought it up, that it is perfect for the format that it is really designed for, which is not the one that Martin Scorsese says, the movie theater. It's perfect for watching at home. And this is I think, a place where I think Scorsese, as much as I love the theatrical experience, he is wrong about this. He made a movie that is actually a great home theater experience if you have like a little home theater at home.
Here's I have to actually disagree with this, because I feel like if you want the effect that you are describing for the passage of time to feel like a journey that you are going through, to feel the real weight of it, you have to kind of be forced to sit there and pay attention to it and not pause and not, you know, stand up and go to the bathroom, not watch it over two nights or three nights or whatever, not break it into your own little mini series, right? I feel like this is the sort of thing that you actually do kind of like need to sit there and absorb.
I agree that you need to, that it's best seen all in one shot, but watching it over a couple of nights, again, extends the amount of time that you are with this story and thinking about it. And I just, you know, I think that the amount of time that the movie takes to get where it's eventually going is totally earned.
Well, and that in part is because where it's eventually going is not really what it's been sold as.
Yeah.
And I feel like I sort of sit between the two of you, because I checked
you
my...
You literally are sitting between the two of us right now.
Literally and figuratively.
For listeners at home.
I checked my watch a lot during the movie, but at the same time I haven't been able to stop thinking about it, and that's because I went into it expecting that, you know, it's primarily going to be about seeing these actors together on screen, it's about, you know, this long-standing mystery that has spawned infinite American conspiracy theories. It's actually a story about a guy becoming estranged from his daughter. Mm-hmm. Who is played,
yes,
later in the film by Anna Paquin.
She has so few lines, how would you even know?
But what's fascinating about it, and this is actually something I'm going to be writing about later in the week. So there's this through line in the story where, you know, De Niro's character has this daughter, Peggy, who's clearly sort of the apple of his eye, and yet with whom there's this sort of constant tension, starting in particular in an early scene where he comes home, finds out that a grocery clerk pushed her in a store and drags her back over to the grocery store and curb stomps the guy. And in that moment, Peggy becomes the only person in the movie who really sees him for what he is. The only person in his family in the movie who really sees him for what he is. And the movie returns to her over and over again. You see just constantly Peggy looking at other people.
Just watching.
Yes. And, in, you know, you see her watching Russell Bufalino, who's constantly trying to win her over. He and his wife haven't been able to have kids. He's buying her expensive skates. He's giving her money. And Frank is constantly sort of pushing them together, and Peggy's pushing back. You see her watching Jimmy Hoffa, who becomes a friend of the family who she really embraces. She is on board with his social message. And she is the person in the family who understands that her father has killed the person that she loved at the behest of the person that she always hated. And the conclusion of the movie is not actually Frank Sheeran murdering Jimmy Hoffa. it's Frank Sheeran going to the bank where his daughter works, waiting in line, and then her closing her teller window when she sees him in the line and walking away. And she doesn't have to have that many lines in the movie. Really, she maybe has 5 or 10 max.
Yeah.
But it is a story.
We should, I'm sorry, we should just note that there was a dumb controversy. There was a non-troversy a couple weeks ago when somebody counted up the number of lines and said, why would you give Anna Paquin this role? It's a nothing role. It doesn't even matter.
It's not a nothing role. It is the most important role in the movie. And the reason that you cast Anna Paquin in it is because she can do an enormous amount with her eyes. It's a movie about a woman watching her father and Anna Paquin.
And judging him.
Yes. And Anna Paquin and is amazingly good at that. I mean, I get, look, counting lines, counting female characters, when you're trying to quantify a massive social problem, and this is a massive problem, it's fine to do that, but context matters. And the idea that the character of Peggy is measured by how many words she speaks in this movie is a colossal misreading. She is the most important character in it.
I loved it. I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's fascinatingly a pair, one of sort of it's sort of fits in with Martin Scorsese's habit of making pairs of thematically linked movies. And so if you take Taxi Driver and King of Comedy, they're both movies about male alienation. If you take Casino and Goodfellas, right, they're both movies about organized crime and sort of the way that it unravels and what it does to people's souls. And if you take The Irishman, I'd gone in thinking, oh, this is just a third movie in the kind of Casino Goodfellas series. No, it's a pair with Silence, because it's an incredibly Catholic film about the wages of sin. And the wages of sin is you lose everything. You lose everything and then you die. You lose your daughter. You lose your ability to kind of be relevant in the world. Often you just die yourself. And there's this kind of funny little bit that, you know, that repeats throughout the film, in which occasionally you meet these kind of supporting side characters. And they're all these like great mob types, you know, that Martin Scorsese does so well in his little supporting characters. And then it will just freeze every now and then and tell you, shot in the face in 1982 outside of his, you know,
exploded.
Right. And it's just, there's this like, just this litany of, here's how all of these people died almost, in almost every case, they died a horrific early death. And it adds up. And over time, you realize that's not just sort of there as like a, you know, post-Quentin Tarantino kind of stylistic touch. It's not just like, oh, here's 70 new wave crime films. This is cool. No, it's there to tell you that all of these people paid the, for the most part, they all paid the same price.
Are we supposed to understand that those are all Frank's victims? It was not 100% clear to me as I was watching it whether or not we were. I may be asking a really dumb question, and when I rewatch it again this week, when it comes out on Netflix, it will be clearer. But it was not immediately clear to me if these were meant to be. Again, when you mention, the reason I bring this up is because you mentioned the crushing weight of sin, and if this is, if we are to understand these as Frank's sins being added up on screen in front of us, I think it actually adds a lot to the thematic value of this specific technique. Mm.
Maybe. I do think, though, that it's worth considering the movie as a pair with Casino as well, because Casino is a movie where De Niro's character's daughter is very important as a pawn, right? I mean, he makes his wife have the baby before they get married because he wants to sort of lock her into the family structure. His wife tries to run away with her. But her perspective is never important. It's never considered. She's not even really a person. She might as well just be a pretty doll. And you never see her father. And this is almost the inverse of that, where, you know, the daughter's perspective is ultimately the thing that matters. And you see, you know, she's in the subject of her father's violence. She's largely protected from his milieu, unlike the way the daughter in Casino is. But she is just the vastly more important framing figure instead of the pawn.
There is a real through line in the way that Scorsese treats female characters. He's very interested in the way that male violence ends up affecting them either often indirectly. And so you go back to Taxi Driver. We talked about this on a previous episode. And the movie is very interested in the way Jodie Foster sort of is affected by Robert De Niro's violence, in the way Sybil Shepherd is affected by his unwanted, sort of weird, socially awkward pursuit, right? This is a consistent thing that he is interested in. Is he basically is arguing that men are a mess and women are in some ways sort of the victims of their
men. The men in this movie are largely not a mess, right? I mean, Jimmy Hoffa is emotional and sort of obsessive, but he's not a dysfunctional human being. Frank,
I don't know that I completely agree with that. He certainly as he is trying to take back his union, in the third quarter of the film, is not acting rationally, is not acting in a way that is,
He makes a lot of bad choices.
Yes, he makes a lot of very bad choices. He makes a lot of, he is somebody who is an obsessed politician who kind of can't get away from the fact that he is, that he's no longer welcome in.
But nobody in this movie is a drunk. Nobody in this movie is doing too much coke. Nobody in this movie is mentally ill. I mean, that sort of bolsters your argument about the wages of sin, because everyone here is cognizant of their decisions, right? And we haven't talked at all about Joe Pesci's performance in this movie, which is, to my mind, one of the best things about it. I will be actively irritated if he is not a front runner for best supporting actor. And part of what's so interesting about it is how still and quiet and, just controlled he is in the movie, in a way that is very much sort of a pushback against the kind of antic, out of control characters he often played before he stepped away from acting.
The one character who may be a little bit nuts is the one played by Stephen Graham, Tony Pro.
Who prompts one of the great all-time anti-Schwartz rants.
Yeah, I thought he was fantastic in this movie. He is the one who I would really like to see get a supporting actor nomination, just because I think he steals every scene that he is in, and considering who he's in with.
Mostly steals them from Al Pacino.
Right, he steals them from Al Pacino and Robert De Niro and, Joe Pesci. That's no mean feat. So I'm a big fan. All right, I'm going to put you guys on the spot. I want you to rank the Scorsese gangster movies. Goodfellas, Casino, Irishman.
I haven't seen Goodfellas.
Ugh. Never mind. I'm not going to do this. This is ridiculous. We should have assigned you to see Goodfellas.
You guys are going to assign me to see all of these eventually, and then I am going to have my revenge by making you watch.
Never. We're not going to watch it.
I'm going to make you watch all of the late 90s and early aughts romantic comedies.
No, that's not going to happen. All right. So
Goodfellas, The Irishman, Casino.
Is that best to worst?
That's best to worst, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you made the point once that Goodfellas is a perfect movie, and you're totally right, as is rarely the case. But it's true.
Time's the easiest.
Goodfellas
Peter.
Is a movie that it's not just that there's nothing wrong with it, it's that everything is perfectly right. And there are so few movies that are like that.
Yes, it's actually Casino, Goodfellas, then in The Irishman. That's the response. That's the correct order. All right. Up this week on Required Viewing is Brick. Alyssa, why are we watching Rian Johnson's high school neo-noir?
We are watching Brick because we are queuing up for Knives Out, Rian Johnson's sort of mannered murder comedy. And this is a mannered but low-budget, low-star-power debut in which Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays Brendan, a Sam Spade-style detective who just happens to be a high school student who is trying to save Amelie DeRaven's Emily, his troubled former girlfriend. It is a hard-boiled high school mystery, and sets us up for Johnson working once again in genre mode with a twist.
Peter, you and I were discussing before we came up that the budget of this movie is interesting. I found it interesting because as I was watching it, I was like, wow, this is like a $4 or $5 million movie, right? And I looked it up, and in fact, it was about a $450,000 movie.
Yeah.
But you were surprised that it cost that much. Why is that?
Well, I guess I wasn't surprised it cost that much, but it didn't look like an expensive movie to me. It looked like a movie that showed what you can do with a really small budget. And so it looks like a movie that is very, very cheap, right? So there's just no big set pieces. There's very few locations. The locations that they do have are all the kinds of things that you can get for very little money. It looks like he just kind of shot it around his neighborhood in California because he did. It looks like the kinds of places he probably frequented as a teenager and as somebody in his early 20s. And so to me, it didn't feel in any way like an expensive film. What it felt like was in some ways was like an exceptionally well-made student film.
Mm.
It felt... It's a very sort of clever application of like a lot of the things that you see in student films, which is use what you have.
Right.
Right. You've got a cast of maybe of actors, virtually none of whom you have heard of or seen before. In this case, Gordon Levitt did have some career beforehand, but was
he
still
had
relative.
A major career beforehand. I don't know why you refuse to believe us on this. Richard Roundtree is in this movie. Shaft is in this movie.
Sure.
Megan Good.
It has a real cast, but this is all part of my point.
The cast feels like the people who you could get for relatively small amounts of money to work for 20 days,
sure.
Which is what they did.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, this is, you know, my thing about this movie, again, and how it looks is not so much the set pieces, which you mentioned are minimal, but they do have a few kind of like modest action sequences. You hear a lot of stuff off screen that you don't see necessarily on screen. But really the thing of it is it just looks great. The cinematography in this movie is amazing. It is clearly shot by somebody with a perfect eye for framing, for shot composition, for light. Yeah. And light is always the trickiest thing in any of these movies. You know, you watch a lot of student films and they're lit poorly. Yeah. Even ones by very good directors like Christopher Nolan. If you go back and watch Following is, it's on the Criterion channel, I think, but it's definitely a Criterion disc. And it is... It is exceptionally well done for what amounts to a student film. It's very clever. It's clever in the Nolan-esque way of messing with narrative structures and kind of inverting timestamps and all that. But it's shot in a very harsh black and white. There are basement scenes that are not lit very well. There's stuff that is washed out on rooftops. And again, like it looks very good for a movie that was as cheap as it was. But it doesn't look like this.
Yeah.
I watched it on Netflix. Brick is on Netflix. If you want to watch it, and it just looks so good. It looks like a professionally done movie.
It is. It's professional, but it's inexpensive professional. The absolute best bit of lighting is the way they transform Gordon Levitt's high schooler's bedroom into a kind of neo-noir detective office. And it's just using, it looks like it's actually, I mean, obviously there's a professional lighting rig in the background, but it is done simply by having the desk lamp, right? Not the desk lamp, the bedroom, sort of the bedside lamp, this little like cheap, like Target looking lamp, serve as the focal point for the light and, you know, making basically the rest of the room black and as if it is being lit entirely by that. It's very clever.
Now, Alyssa, don't you think this movie is a little bit precious?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that there is sort of a central mistake in the decision making about it, because what's clever about the conceit is that it's a way of expressing sort of the emotional violence of high school, and the sort of the sense of heightened emotion, the sense that, you know, maybe you're the person who can actually do something about these bigger problems when actually you can't because you're 16. And I think it is a mistake to have the movie end up including multiple murders, right? Because the conceit becomes less clever. If these kids actually are literal, like, drug kingpins who are murdering people and hiring people to stab people on the regular.
Well, the drug kingpin is old. He's like 26 or something.
Right,
remember?
Right,
He's
right.
not a high schooler.
Sure. But, I mean, one of their fellow high school students is going around, like, sort of murdering people.
Yeah, just, like, murdering
randomly.
Lots of people.
And I think that is an error, right? Because the inciting death that kicks off the movie, Emily's overdose, makes sense as the kind of really fraught high school catastrophe that would set off a whole chain of repercussions. But having these kids actually go around killing a lot of people and being as sophisticated as they are undermines both the metaphor and sort of the film noir of it all. Because, you know, in film noir, like, people's evil kind of outs them. Not everyone is actually that super competent. And so I think he doesn't quite nail the balance of his conceit in a way that makes it not a great movie, but certainly a very interesting one.
My issue with it is that it has a lot of lines that look great on the page that don't necessarily sound good as dialogue. For instance, it's just a very brief thing, but and this has happened to me both times I watched it now. I realized this after I was done watching it. But there's a line where Joseph Gordon-Levitt, his character says something like, I'm headed to bed. I've got knives in my eyes. Yeah. But he says it so quickly and like kind of just like nonchalantly that I was like, wait, he's got what? He's got, and I have to like rewind it. And then I have to actually think about it for a second to realize, okay, he's saying he has a headache. And like, it is clever and it's cute. Yeah. But the movie is filled with stuff like this.
I love the hard-boiled dialogue.
No, but see, it is.
But it works
there's a difference
in some scenes than others, right?
There's,
like,
right,
his
totally.
Confrontation with the vice principal.
Yeah.
Like, it, again, it's the, you know, Sam Spade confronts the probably corrupt cop and has it out with him. But the language there works to, you know, suss out what each person is actually feeling.
I got all five senses and I slept last night, which puts me six up on the lot of you, right?
Like, yeah, well, right.
It's a great little line.
Sure. That works okay, but I feel like
they are weird lines, but Gordon Levitt sells every one of them.
You can get away with some of those. You can get away with a handful of those in addition to like the general noir patter. Yeah. Like, because it's not like he is just aping things that he has heard in movies. He's like rewriting it. He's like creating new versions of it, which fine. Again, it's like good and interesting, and I think it's something that reads a little better on the page than it does actually coming out of people's mouths.
It works better in the scenes where the metaphor is better calibrated.
Yeah.
We should talk about some of the metaphors and also, you know, sort of the confrontation with the vice principal. It's a great little bit of world building. And again, this goes back to why I was talking about this being feeling in some ways like an exceptionally clever student film, is that he took a relatively small number of easy to access elements. Just, you know, a high school football field and locker hall, you know, a 1970s California house basement, maybe
the
50s, 60s, whatever.
Where the drama kids hang out.
Just there's nothing that looks like it was difficult to come by in this movie, right? The cars are all just like, I borrowed a van, you know, it's stuff he had on hand. And yet the world he creates has such depth to it and yet is also really accessible, right? Like that great bit about like who she having lunch with.
Yeah.
Right? And you suddenly understand, oh, of course, we all remember how the high school cafeteria was like a zone for like understanding social class,
social
and like
hierarchy.
What was going on.
And yet
we never even see the cafeteria itself.
Yes. But I mean, and every teen movie has its fantastic version of that. In fact, 10 Things I Hate About You, in which Joseph Gordon-Levitt also stars as a high school student, but this time as like a totally puppy dog narrator and sort of object of romance, has a scene like that that is also perfectly tailored to the sort of Shakespearean meets California riff that it's doing. And so it's not so much that, you know, this is an area where Rian Johnson has like discovered something new, but he's made his metaphor match his scenario precisely in that scene.
All right. That is all for this week's Required Viewing. Thank you very much, Alyssa and Peter. Next week's Required Viewing is American Sniper, the movie that kicked off Clint Eastwood's American Hero cycle. That is it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple. We need those reviews, people. And if you didn't love it, complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyBunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you all next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sanye. Associate producer, Jessica Safa-Vamere. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.